Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Sometimes inspiration will come out of the blue, and that's great. But a lot of the time, you just have to put yourself in the space to accept some. You know, it's like a job. So if you show up to work, right, you might have a bad day's work, but you've worked.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Balancing Acts. In this conversation, I talk to comedian and rapper Joe Jacobs. Perfect.
Hi, this is Steve Whiteley, comedian, actor, filmmaker and writer, all-round ADHD creative. And welcome to my new podcast, Balancing Acts, where I talk to an array of creatives ranging from comedians, actors, directors, all sorts. And we talk about how they find a sense of balance or not between their creative lives and their everyday lives and how that has an impact on their mental health and beyond.
Balancing Acts is made in association with The Comedy Crowd, who support independent comedy creators. They showcase the best new videos on comedycrowdtv.com and across media platforms. They support independent comedy creators and showcase the best new videos, including adult animation, sketch shows, web series, viral hits, and lots more. So if you're a creator, then do check them out.
As a comedian, Joe has performed nationally and internationally, sharing bills with the likes of Bill Burr and Stuart Lee. He's been on Channel 4, BBC Radio 4, BBC 6, Radio 1 Extra. He recently performed on Harry Hill's Club Night on Channel 4, and his documentary Hip Hop's Laughingstock was recently broadcast on BBC Radio 4. As a rapper, going under the name Jester Jacobs, Joe's music has been heard on BBC 6 Music, Radio 1 Extra, and he's consistently put out music since his debut, Mental Disorder, in 2008. Joe has also performed two critically acclaimed solo shows at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, and his videos online have received millions of views. I really enjoyed chatting with Joe. I first came across him because my act Weisbaum incorporates, I guess some people would describe rap, but it's sort of under the pretense that he's a spoken word artist. And when I was in Edinburgh, thinking about in 2016, someone said, "Oh, you must meet the other Jewish comedian who does rap." And he says, "Joe Jacobs." And I think that's when I first came across Joe, and then have gigged with him quite a few times and have always enjoyed his sets. He's very funny, sharp, and he kind of like effortlessly weaves between incorporating his rap, which is sort of like comedic, you know, in tone, into his sets, but also often just goes on stage just doing straight stand-up. So he can do either or combine the two together. And we covered a load of ground. We talked about our experience of being fellow Jews and growing up in the North London hood, both attending Hebrew school and describing our displeasure for that. And Joe talks about how important it is to keep perspective during these uncertain times and how that has helped him get over the negative impact that this has caused on the stand-up world and his career. He describes the struggle of writing new material when you don't have the deadline of gigs. Joe breaks down his approach to creativity and the importance of having structure and routine to your writing and creating, and why he enjoys writing new material just before he goes on stage. He explains how he deals with the anxiety of performing and the adrenaline of that comes with having a really great gig, and how he kind of got to a point where he didn't let it affect him as much. Joe explains the experience of his BBC Radio 4 documentary and also breaks down how that happened and what it was like having his mum and sister feature in the documentary. He talks about why he finds it so hard to work in a traditional career type job, and the difficulty with feeling joyful but not looking like he has a joyful face. according to some of his friends. We exchange our stories of getting mugged in the burbs and how smoking weed affected our teenage years. Joe also talks about his mindfulness practice and how that has added a sort of new layer to his life and, I guess, creativity as well. And the difficulty with releasing content when you spend so much time on a project, whether it be a video or a piece of music, and then it not receiving loads of online love. Joe emphasizes the importance of doing nothing. So, you know, if you're trying to figure out what to do next in terms of like creating content or whatever kind of creative endeavor it might be, not rushing it and just chasing the highs that come with releasing content, because as Joe explains, they are meaningless. So there is loads here. I think you're going to really enjoy this one. Joe keeps it real and is very honest throughout this. And I have a huge amount of respect for people who come on and just totally open and honest. So shout out and a big thank you to Joe for that. And I'm feeling all right. I'm feeling quite calm. I did mention at the end of the last episode that I would be going on a meditation retreat. And I did that last weekend. And I'm feeling very calm off the back of it. 5 hours of sitting down meditating every day is going to do that to you. And yeah, it's it's a good thing. Something I think everybody should experience at least once. Just go on there and just do it. I mean, the first bit, if you haven't done one of them before, you know, you are wriggling around. It's very difficult to keep still. But after a while, you settle into it and it's all right. And the voices, those annoying voices in your mind, "What are you doing, mate?" They're there, but they're kind of quiet down. Anyway, if you haven't done it, definitely worth doing. And as always, if you like this episode, if you like Balancing Acts, the series, please do rate and review it on Apple, subscribe, all that jazz. Namaste very much. So without further ado, over to Joe Jacobs. Perfect.
First of all, how's your Yom Kippur been, Joe?
Yeah, it's been all right.
Did you fast?
No.
Neither did I. I take it you're not the religious type of Jew.
Nah, I'm not religious. I like certain parts of Judaism. I like certain things, but...
As in the cultural side of things?
I like the cultural things, and there's a few elements of Judaism which I think is interesting. Not many, but a few. I like the Torah with the finger.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah, the finger, yeah. Where did that come from?
I think it's because the Torah, because it's made out of like animal skin or something, right? The original, the proper Torahs are made of animal hide. I might be way off, but the little finger, I believe it might be for two reasons. First of all, so you don't smudge the religious text. And also probably because like God probably wouldn't want you to touch it, maybe.
Yeah, some good.
That's why you got to keep your head covered. Because God doesn't want to see your head, you know.
Did you go to Hebrew school? By the sounds of it, you did.
Yeah, I went to a Hebrew school.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I did not enjoy it.
No, my one was shit as well. My synagogue was trash, man. It was...
Where was yours?
It was Edgware. It was Edgware Reform.
Oh, yeah. It was like I live around the corner from there.
Yeah, man. Edgware Reform. It's like, it looks like Alcatraz. And inside isn't much better. Anyway, on the subject of Torahs, yeah, I remember being taught, and I'd love to fact check this, that when a rabbi is writing the Torah scrolls, if he makes a mistake, he can't destroy the bit of scroll, because if in Judaism, if you write God, you have to do a dash with it, because you can't ever remove God's name, you know, because it's holy. You can't just rub out God. So lots of Jews will write G-D. I used to do it because I was scared of God.
Yeah, it was sort of, I did the same. That was kind of like instilled into you in Hebrew.
Yeah, class. And it's like, you're scared of God. I grew up and then eventually I was like, how petty is God that this is the thing that's going to bother him out of everything? Like, really? He can like, have a go at you
one
for
thing.
That. But like, I noticed you didn't cover your head all of your life. Well, no, I'm sorry. Well, what about when you wrote my name out? You didn't put the dash on it. You scribbled it all up. Yeah. Anyway, I read that the so if a rabbi or whoever writes the Torah messes up on the scroll with God's name on a page, they can't destroy that. So apparently, maybe there's like a vault of all these Torahs pages that got spelling errors on it. I doubt it.
Yeah, because it's sort of like this never-ending paper, isn't it? So if you did muck it up.
Yeah, that's true as well. That's interesting. Maybe you should do a new podcast about the Torah.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
It is. Well, you know, funny enough, just talking to my flatmate, and he's working on a project with this writer-director who's kind of doing this feature on these Hasidic Jews who moved to Canvey Island to start their own community. There's like four families moved to Canvey Island. And anyway, one of them, Moishi, surprise, surprise, is a real character and wants to do a podcast about him as a Hasidic Jew meeting other people outside of his community.
Okay. What's his name? Moishi.
Moishi.
Good name.
So did you grow up around there, around Edgware?
Kind of, yeah, those sides, yeah. How about you?
Yeah.
How are you, man?
Yeah, I'm all right. It's been a weird few months, isn't it? It has been a weird few months, but...
Not into it and not feeling it.
No. How have you coped mentally with it all, emotionally and all that sort of stuff? And all that sort of stuff.
Mostly, really, I've been all right. It's good days, bad days, but I try and keep some perspective because a lot of people have it worse.
Yeah, this is true.
Work's been pretty slow. I've tried to do what I can do.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Have you started gigging again?
I've done a few gigs, not near to the amount I was doing. I lost a lot of work. Things were starting to pick up really nicely, and
because you, I saw the So Toxic set, and that went viral at the beginning of the year. That was banging, and then obviously the Harry Hills Club night. You building up some serious momentum. Felt like.
Yeah, but I mean, what is momentum really? I don't know. But I was working hard and, yeah, I was trying to just keep it moving. And then this stuff happened and then everyone was like streaming and being big YouTube stars and all that. And I tried to make YouTube videos, but that's when I really actually felt depressed, when I was trying to engage on a different platform rapidly.
Right.
I didn't really fall into that trap. A lot of people kind of were just pissing out anything and trying to be like Noella. In a fortnight or whatever.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a different ball game. But I did bits and bobs. I had a lot of music and music videos planned, and I was just working on that, really. And I worked on my radio show.
Which was great. Congratulations. It was a really enjoyable listen.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was wicked to hear that whole journey for you.
I only introduced rap into the stand-up quite late on. I did years of no music.
Okay.
And I like to do lots of pure stand-up and put music in where it's appropriate. I don't try and jam it in every time necessarily.
Yeah.
Definitely want to write material as a priority and not use music too much as like a backup. It's always nice to have as a backup though.
Yeah, for sure. Get out of jail card.
Yeah. But I definitely try and be proficient with both at all times.
Are you finding it hard at the moment to write material, stand-up material?
Yeah. I write bits and bobs, but I'm finding it hard to write because I don't have the gigs to roll out new stuff.
Yeah, just try new stuff out.
That's where I do a lot of the work. When I'm on a stage, I know I got a gig, I know I got to put in a few new jokes or try a few new ideas, and without that, I'm just writing ideas down when they come to me, but there's no deadline as such, so it's a bit trickier. But I try and do other creative things, try and just write.
Yeah,
I've been a bit undisciplined with it. I again, back when things were normal, I had routine. Routine is so important to me for creativity, and when COVID happened, I just lost a lot of the structure of my routine. I had to make a new one.
And so
I forgot about stand up when COVID happened, really. I just accepted, so I'm such a pessimist. I just accepted that comedy was gone forever.
Is that what you genuinely thought that?
Yeah.
Right.
At the beginning.
Okay.
I was like, well, if there was something designed to ruin stand up comedy, I think this virus is it, really, because it's like small spaces, airborne. No laughing because it spreads it, all these sort of things. And I thought, well, I guess that's me then. I'm done. But it was fun. Genuinely thought, people around me were like, no, it will come back.
Yeah.
Eventually. And I'm like, nah, no, I don't see it coming back ever. But that's how much of a pessimist I am. That's what I thought. And I let it all go. I stopped thinking about it for months.
And what was that like? Just letting it go.
It was horrible. It was horrible. But, you know, what we do is a privilege. So can't, you have to just take it on the chin, you know?
Yeah.
What we do is a privilege. No one should expect to be able to prat about on a stage and be paid. It's a very, very silly thing to do. And I felt that all my chickens were coming home to roost over the last few months, particularly like this is what happens when you dare to dream.
Right. Okay.
Reality will come back.
Bites on the bum. Yeah. So talk to me about, you're saying you're very structured prior to lockdown in terms of your creativity. How would that manifest? Like, would you like every day set out how you're going to structure your day and like what to focus on different projects?
Well, yeah, I realize that makes me sound a lot more organized and disciplined than the reality.
Okay.
But what I guess it means is I've realized taken years and years and years, but sometimes inspiration will come out of the blue and that's great. But a lot of the time you just have to put yourself in the space to accept some, you know, it's like a job. So if you show up to work, right, you might have a bad day's work, but you've worked.
Yeah.
So I used to, like, when I write songs, sometimes like with writer's block and same with comedy and jokes, you might write a pile of shit, but you did write. And out of all of that work, something good, a little nugget, a sentence, a phrase might come out of it. And the routine of knowing that every day you're going to be at a desk for this period of time on this hour, your brain eventually gets in gear and it's like, all right, well, we might as well try and pull something out the bag here.
Yeah.
So that's my approach. Yeah. And I like the time before gigs as well for comedy specifically, because I'm so lazy that I'll put everything off until the last possible minute, usually right before I'm about to go on a stage. So then I'm like, oh shit, I really have to figure something out. And I find that my mind in those moments my mind is quite open to navigating and constructing a bit of material right before I do a set.
Right. So you turn up to the gig with a general idea of what you were going to be doing and then just sort of go into like turbocharge mode to sort of figure out the set prior to going on stage.
Yeah. The way I write material, it's always different. It's sometimes I'll have a fully formed joke set up punchline and I'm like, I got to try this full joke. Sometimes I'll have a theme that I want to explore and I'll just go on with very little and just see what happens. And other times, like the copy of a joke will sort of present itself to me in the hour or so before I'm on stage.
Okay.
Just because of a heightened mind, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
That makes sense?
Yeah, completely. So when you do a gig and you've absolutely killed, how are you after? Are you at a point now where kind of that adrenaline isn't as overpowering as it was when you first started to feel that? Or is it still like you're going home and you're buzzing thinking about it?
I got to the point where it sort of leveled out a bit.
Okay.
And it didn't overwhelm me. Sometimes you have a great gig and you feel it and you feel good. But I got to the point where it sort of was stable and manageable, which I think is good.
Yeah.
Like, because also it meant that I wasn't, because I remember when I started for years, when I was shit as well, the anxiety of doing a gig, I'd have it all day.
Okay.
I'd do the gig. If the gig went badly, which it usually did in those days, I would feel it for another day or maybe at least that evening.
Yeah.
If the gig went well, I'd be walking on air and like absolutely off my tits on adrenaline for the whole evening. And that's all I could think about. And that's not really healthy either, but I did so much comedy and was around gigs and that lifestyle for so long that eventually I got to the point where I didn't really think about it in the day. 10 minutes before I start limbering up, I could just walk on, do the gig, leave, feel kind of normal, and then that's it, which is a better way to be, I think.
Yeah, that's a healthy place to be. And is the same applicable if you died on stage as well? You got to a point where you can just sort of shrug it off.
Oh, no. You remember that.
Yeah.
Forever. But what happens is they become less frequent, those tougher gigs. And you do, if it was an average show, you can write it off a bit easier. If we're talking about a spectacular death, then you do have to have a think about what caused that. But eventually it all becomes kind of manageable over time, in my experience.
Yeah. So talking about the documentary, Hip Hop's Laughing Stock, how did that come about? Because I know, you know, obviously when you're tweeting about it, you don't have a manager or an agent. So it's like, it's a pretty amazing feat to get, you know, land a documentary, that and also getting, you know, on the Harry Hill show, etc. You've done that off the back of your own hustle. How did that come about?
So the Hip Hop Laughing Stock thing came about because there's a DJ I know from the rap world called DJ Trice, shouts to Trice. And he was involved in, I don't even know what it was called, some sort of like, I'm going to just butcher this, some like working class fellowship or something.
Okay.
I don't even know, but it's for people who are trying to get a start in, you know, audio documentaries and that industry, where usually they won't sort of, where it's, you know, full of who you know and nepotism and that shit. And it gives people a chance to break in and work on commissions and get stuff off the ground. And he was one of the people that was working, was involved in that. And he had this idea and he approached me about being a contributor in it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I met the producers and basically I just managed to convince them to make it all about me.
Perfect.
I didn't really, but it ended up being about me. I just went in and spoke a lot, and eventually they were like, well, they asked me, can we make it with more focus on you? And I said, hell yeah, I would love that. And it was a really, it was such a great thing to make. I really like working with Trice and Reduce Listening, the company that helped push it. It's been great.
Yeah. Was it quite a cathartic experience? Because, you know, you're able to like travel back and go through your career, you know, starting off with rapping and then the transition to comedy and getting to this point you're at now.
Yeah, it was really cathartic. And yeah, absolutely. And it felt like, I don't know, like, because obviously all of this stuff is meaningless, you know, making content and everything. But it was nice to have a little story told about what I did, I'd done.
Yeah, for sure. And I love the bits you know, with your mum and your sister, your mum.
The thing with my mum that's funny is she's like a proper Jewish mother. She thought she's so funny. Yeah. Oh, you got to get me on this. I'm hilarious. I got so many things to say. I'll be amazing. Yeah. The second the mic comes out, we recorded an hour of her.
Yeah.
All rubbish. The second that mic came out, she didn't know what she was doing. She just kept making up stories and lies. She's just making shit up just because she was panicking. It was amazing what happens when a mic is produced. She thought she was the funniest person in the room. But yeah, so we got a bit out of her in the end. And my sister, oh yeah, that was right, because my mum was trying to be funny, just lying.
We're just in lying about what? Okay, so when she's talking about describing you as being very serious, is that factual or is that her bullshit?
That was factual, but here's a lie that she said. She said, at one point we asked her, did you ever hear me rapping when I was younger? And she goes, oh, yeah, I used to hear you rapping all the time. Really? Where did you hear me rapping? Oh, in the garden, in the garden. It's just bollocks. She was just making up stuff because she didn't really know what to say.
She felt nervous.
What happened was we interviewed her. She was giving us nothing. And then my sister was in the room at the time, and she basically sort of interrupted to sort of say, you need to stop rapping and you need to take your life more seriously. And then the producer's like, hang on a minute, let's talk to your sister here about it. And she kind of gave us the goods. That's what we were after, someone
giving
a reality check.
Perfect.
Hello, sorry to interrupt in the middle of this insightful conversation, which I'm enjoying, I'm sure, just as much as you are, but I need to give you guys a little reminder. If you like this conversation, this episode, if you like balancing acts in general, then please do subscribe to us, rate and review us, because it makes the world of difference. And the more reviews we get, the more rates we get, the more people can discover the podcast and we can make it go viral, whatever that means. Okay, back to the chat. What was it like? Because I mean, I know from my experiences of getting into comedy and doing that sort of stuff, the anxiety that it caused my parents, you know, they wanted me to have, you know, a safe and secure job and all that sort of stuff. Were your parents like that? Because particularly in, you know, the Jewish family like world, a lot of people do grow up to be lawyers and accountants and so forth. How were your family when you sort of got into rap and you basically decided that's what you wanted to do as a career, and then obviously comedy as well?
What's funny is my parents never gave a shit about anything I did creatively, professionally. I never knew any judgment from my father or mother to be a doctor or a lawyer, anything. They really, and it was mostly because of negligence rather than it wasn't due to like encouraging me to follow my dreams. They just literally, you know, they weren't present. They weren't catering to my emotional needs. So they were divorced when I was a young boy.
Okay.
So I actually resent them for that. I would have preferred them to really make me hit the books and be a doctor or something, making some serious dough, because this is not working out. I want money.
You need the cashish, mate. So what about your mates then from that you grew up with? Have some of them gone down the routes of like, you know, professional, sensible careers? And if so, like, do you find that you're looking at them like, oh, fuck, I want what they've got. I want a nice piece of stability.
Yeah, man. A lot of them are very successful, got homes, you know, married, kids. This is a good example of where I'm at and the differences between me and my friends. I saw a pal last Sunday for lunch.
Yeah.
And he was with his wife and young baby.
Mm-hmm.
And I showed him my push pop that I'd just bought. Yeah, lovely. I had a push pop mega duo, and I showed him it with strawberry and cola flavor. And that's sort of the difference between me and most people I know.
Was he impressed?
He's got a child. I've got a push pop. He was as about impressed as you would expect. But I made my choices. I made my bed. I got a push pop. But yeah, I would like to have. Yeah, I mean, I've done things. I've worked in the corporate world and had proper jobs and shit jobs, all kinds of jobs.
Yeah.
And the truth is, for better or worse, I actually can't function in that world. I wish I could.
Yeah.
I wish I could. I just can't.
Because what? You can't be in an office environment.
No, I've been in an office environment and I'll probably be in one again.
Yeah.
But in terms of playing the game and progressing up ladders.
Oh, right. All that stuff. Yeah, yeah.
I'm incapable. I can't pretend to care.
Right.
Right. I think actually might go back to, because I said my family are divorced. I actually think a lot of that is down to upbringing, because whenever I was in an office, I always used to see the people that were getting ahead and promoted and all that. And they were the ones that really embraced the culture of a working environment. You know, when a boss used to say things in the big staff meetings like, oh, we're all a big family here. I was like, I don't have a proper family. I don't want to be in your family. What kind of family is this? You go to Mauritius with the secretary and I do spreadsheets. This is a shit family. I don't want to be in this family. And that's probably why I never got promoted. Also, recently, a friend of mine has told me that she thinks I have no joy. She thinks I look like I have no joy, which I was very shocked to hear, because I thought I could pretend to have some joy. So I've realized this is actually over lockdown as well. I've realized I haven't been as convincing.
Right.
As I thought.
You need to get method. Basically, you need to find actual joy so you can be convincingly joyful.
Well, that's the thing. I have joy. I have a lot of joy for all kinds of things, but I guess when I'm supposed to have some joy in front of someone, I might not look like I have the joy. And that, I think that's cost me over the years, because like in a job, my friend also said this to me years ago when I asked him, I said, why aren't I getting promoted? This is someone about, I don't even know, like 7 years ago, a good friend of mine. I'm like, why aren't I getting promoted? I don't get it. And he said, well, think about the people in your office that do get promoted and that do well and thrive. Think about their faces every day and how they engage with their colleagues and they take pride in their work and how they carry themselves, how they walk around. And I'm like, yeah, I can picture that. And he said, think about you now when you arrive in the office with that face of yours and you're looking at your laptop all day with your headphones in, hunched over, And I said, all right, now I understand. Yeah, that makes sense.
I can relate to that.
But you're very... really good looking. You've got a lot of joy.
You're good looking. When we did the MCA gig a couple years ago, my mate's wife thought you were very fit. And really? They have like these code words for if there's someone that they think's fit, they think it's better to sort of like have it out in the open. So they'll say, oh, that's a chicken. So a fit person's a chicken. So she thought you were a chicken.
Chicken.
A chicken, yeah.
So, yeah. That's great. That's always nice to hear.
It's nice to hear. There's a bit of joy there for you. A bit of joy.
That's good.
Great. Yeah. When you were growing up in the suburbs, did you, like, for me, it was very, my teenage years were very weed and skunk induced whilst listening to pirate radio and going to raves. Did you have a similar setting?
Yeah.
Do you Absolutely. Think, were you a big Bunner? So a Bunner, for people who don't know, is like a big, it's is that a North London town? I don't know, but did you use
big
Bunner?
Bunner.
Did you ever use Bunner? We used to, we used to bun that smoked lots of weed.
I'd never say you a bunner.
You a bunner, we used to say that.
It's close to bumming.
It is, yeah. It is.
Bun sounds, anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was a huge cannabis smoker.
Right, for a long time.
Huge, for years and years. Well, when I was a kid, yeah, that's what we did in those days. Kids today, they don't understand that back in the day, all we had, we didn't have phones. We just had cannabis and bus stops and stuff. Well, no, we had cannabis and phones. There was cannabis and street robbery. That was all we had when we were teenagers.
Not street robbery, yeah.
Kids today, I think when I see kids outside the Supreme shop in thousands of pounds of clothing, I think we should bring back street robbery sometimes, because some of these kids, I don't know what's going on, walking around with iPhone Xs and this LV shit. Anyway,
I agree. Also, I think muggings in particular, they were a bit of an art form back then. Like you know, it wasn't now where you just, you know, bring out a gun or whatever. There was a whole repertoire that went with it. And you had to, you know, I thought that you had to be quite creative.
Yeah, you had all different types of mugging. You had, oh man, I had some classics. They had the knife under the hoodie.
Oh yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Well, it's like, I got a knife, I'm gonna stab you. And then you think, is that a knife or is it just your hand? Do you want to take that risk?
Don't
for
want
a 30
to take that risk. Percent? No.
I remember that one. I remember I didn't get jacked too many times, but the one time that we did get nailed was we were around Finchley. We decided to like try and buy some fags or something. It must have been about 14, 15. Maybe 3 a.m. We walk around to the high street and basically this guy comes up to us in a hurry, agitated. And he's like, all right, guys, there's the group behind me. They're trying to jack me. Help me out. Please help me. You got to help me. If you give me your phone, I'll call my brother. He'll come down. And I'm like, all right, stay with us. We turn around. There's like a gang of six fucking hooded up people heading towards us quickly, no one on the streets. And then we turn the corner and the guy that sort of first spoke to us, he was like the ringleader and he just set us up basically. So that was quite a good one. I remember once we got honey trapped when we were kids. We all thought we were gonna meet some girls in the park when we were like 15. I wasn't the person who organized it, someone else did, because No, we weren't even 15, pretty younger. We were going to meet them in the park and it was just going to basically, I don't even know what we were expecting would happen. But we get there, we're hanging out, it's dark, we're in an enclosure. And the girl, she basically just called a load of bigger boys to come and just fuck shit up. That was quite good.
Dark.
I wrote a song about it on my first album. On my first album, I got a track called Run, which is all about getting jacked. And it's one of my favorites from back in the day, because like you always hear about people doing crime and rap, and it's funny to write a song about being on the receiving end of crime.
Yeah, one of the most creative ones I had was one on a bus from Stanmore to Hatch End, and these
gully ends,
bro.
Grandma lived in Hatch End.
Yeah. Mine lived in Harrow. Yeah, I've been my way to see her actually. And these kids got on in hoods, and me and my friend were sitting in the back, and one of them went over to talk to him and the other one went to talk to me. We're sort of on the back of the bus. And the guy talked to me. He's like, do you want me to show you a magic trick? I was like, yeah, all right. He goes, give me fiver. So I gave him my fiver, puts it in his pocket, gone. I was like, oh, that's cool. Can I have it back, please? Literally, I thought up to that point, it genuinely was a magic trick.
That's quite impressive. Jacking story I've heard, I think.
Yeah, it's a good one. It's good. And we had these two kids. I don't know if you ever came across them, but in Edgeware, they were notorious. They're called Ali and Isaiah. They used to mug everyone. They were the guys that made it an art form. Like, all the other muggers looked up to those two.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. We used to hang around.
You knew their names?
They were notorious, man. You ask anyone that grew up in Edgeware, at that time, everyone knew them. Everyone knew them. I know they'd come from Graham Park Estate. They turn up at Edgeware Station. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
What they'd get in early, put in a long shift.
Still grafters, to be fair to them. They were grafters. That's actually where I learned my work ethic from, those guys. Yeah. But I always think about it. Sometimes I Google Ali and Isaiah. I just don't get it. Nothing comes up. It's a shame I don't know their last names. It might not even be their names. It might have just been the stage name. Maybe. Back to the weed smoking. Do you think, because I know from my experiences anyway, that smoking that amount of skunk has had a long lasting impact on me on my later years.
I think it certainly is very dangerous for certain individuals. I think it's a tough one to broach because I don't want to ever stop anyone experimenting and doing whatever they want to do. I would never do that.
Yeah.
But that said, I think Britain has a culture, like with alcohol, when it comes to drugs, that we just have to take everything to excess.
Yeah.
Even drugs. Like the reason I don't really smoke weed anymore. I haven't done drugs in a few years now. Any drugs. The time I knew that I had to cut back on the skunk was when it was like a competition. It wasn't sociable anymore.
Yeah.
We used to share a joint in the park when we were kids. I started young. I started at like 12 smoking weed, and we used to share joints, and it was a communal ritual. And then years down the line, it got to the stage where you spend your whole evening with a group of guys. You'd all buy a bag, sit and smoke individual spliffs all fucking night doing whatever. And I was like, I can't do this anymore. This is shit. What's this about? I love you guys, but this is shit. Yeah. And it affected my ability. I was self-medicating, so it probably affected me mentally with mental health. It definitely affected my confidence. It inhibited me in loads of ways. I think it probably affected my relationships with all kinds of people, relationships with the opposite sex as well, because you're just a nervous wreck.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't make you want to chat up women.
No.
So yeah, and then also when I started doing comedy more seriously, when I was rapping and being a rap guy, that didn't really matter because you can just be high and do that shit. Yeah. In fact, it's encouraged. But with comedy, I had to make a decision about whether I wanted to really pursue it properly and give it everything. And that's when I had to just stop doing all drugs because the two don't work together, really. You can't be out getting fucked up and then doing a good set the next day. It just doesn't work. You lose parts of your brain matter.
So how many years ago was that when you decided to knock it all on the head?
Weed, I can't even remember. But like I smoke, I got like a little weed vape that I have, a little disposable thing. Like I'll have a puff really, really rarely. Like I had some in Ibiza, you know, I like a bit of hash now and again, but definitely, certainly not to excess ever.
Same.
And I quit real drugs. I was fucking getting mashed up all the time. That was maybe like 4 years ago.
Okay. It's funny now. Were you doing sort of the, well, usual class A type stuff?
Yeah, a lot of crack as well.
Never done the old crack?
Never. No, Major. Never. Nah, I did crack, but I was like, I needed professional help because I was, like I said, self-medicating, and luckily it all came to a head before I needed any professional intervention.
Yeah.
Why are we talking about this? This is like therapy in here.
Yeah, that's
we're talking about that's process.
That's what people tend to say, is that these chats tend to be a little bit therapeutic in some sense. But unlike other therapists, I don't charge, Joe. So
yeah, that's good. One thing I will say about weed is I wish I could have a high tolerance for weed and just smoke it all the time and feel great and feel
Joe Rogan. I don't know, is that Joe Rogan? That dude is just like, he's doing these sort of deep conversations for 3 hours and just getting fucking high.
I don't know how deep they are. The guy's a meathead, but a successful one.
We to talk for 3 hours, like with someone face to face and just getting high. I couldn't do that.
You ever hung out with a pothead? They do it very easily.
Just chat shit.
Yeah, comes naturally. It's not like he adds much insight into the proceedings.
I think I would maybe be like two in my head, or I'd like freak out, you know, especially if streamed across the world.
Definitely. That's what I mean. I wish I had the tolerance to smoke loads of weed. Chong it constantly, go out, party, take everything, get 2 hours sleep, do my gigs, but it doesn't work.
It's the Jewish neurotic gene. It doesn't go hand in hand with the hard drug taking. And the drink, yeah. Drink I'm a little bit better with. But I used to be a big binge drinker, as I'm sure you did as well.
Is there any other way?
No, not when the hooch is cheap. So what do you do, like, when you're not outside of comedy? Going back, I guess, what we're talking about in terms of, like, joy, etc., what's your downtime consist of? Do you exercise, you meditate or anything like that?
Exercise, rarely. I try and walk a dog. I'm about to start exercising properly. It's only taken me decades.
What's brought that light? Is it because of, like, lockdown? You just need to...
I need to sort myself out. Right. I want to be ripped. I want to take steroids.
Just do that, mate. Don't need to exercise. Just take steroids.
You still need to figure out what to do once you take them. I've been speaking to Darius Davies. He'll get me on the roids. I don't know if he is on roids, but he'd help me secure them. I'm not going to take steroids. I'm just rambling. I like to meditate. I'm into mindfulness very much.
Oh, yeah. How long have you been doing that for?
But meditating about a year.
Okay.
But that sort of mindful attitude for a few years. I read a lot about it. I practice a lot of that stuff in my day-to-day life.
So outside of meditation, you'll practice it? Okay.
Yeah.
So give me an example.
Like sort of processes that people might take, like, I know people in recovery, they write gratitude lists, and that's what I don't write them, but I do like to take perspective on everything that's going on and actually appreciate what I have, be grateful for what I have, see the positives in what's going on, like, regularly, times a day.
That's not pessimistic.
I know I'm not. But I have to fight against being pessimistic and being miserable.
Right. Yeah.
That's my default.
Yeah.
I don't want it to be.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of life is beautiful and I'm thankful and appreciative for life every day.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean I can't fucking moan about some shit comedian that's on TV that I'm not, you know?
Yeah.
And I have to say, well, I'm grateful that I've had X, Y, Z. Well, they're a nice person. I wish them the best, you know?
Yeah, you feel better for it.
Believe it.
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
You don't want to be bitter and angry forever. It's exhausting.
Have you kind of always been that way inclined in terms of if you see other comedians, maybe who started out at the same time as you and they've progressed a lot further, have you found that difficult to sort of deal with in terms of, like, getting bitter and that type of thing?
Well, I'm friends with a lot of comedians that are pretty much celebrities at this point.
Yeah.
And I'm really happy for them.
Yeah.
Genuinely. They're good people, good acts.
Yeah.
And they work for it and they deserve it. Some people, if they're like wrong-uns, and there's a few of them in comedy, that's a bit more complicated.
Yeah.
And I'd probably be lying if I said I didn't resent that because, you know, maybe I should be more successful because I haven't raped anyone, for example, but
put that on your poster.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, it's easy to resent people, but man, this industry is it's cutthroat, so you need to try and get it out your system as best you can. the problem is it's all judged by your peers. You know, you judge where others are at, because what's the barometer? What else is there? That's why there's a lot of creeps in comedy. There's no HR department. You can't go and talk to someone about how you're getting on at work. It's like, it's meaningless metrics of success that you're putting up for yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've had to adjust those as I've got on in this and got older, certainly. Because it's like you got to take stock of where you're at. Like when I started this, the things I ended up doing so far, I would never dream that it would happen.
Exactly, yeah.
It's mad.
Yeah.
And I'm not rich from comedy. I'm not particularly well known, but it's still a joy, and I've still done a lot of cool shit, crazy shit, but I never thought I'd do. And that's enough. That might be it. That might be as good as it gets. And I've got to be thankful for it anyway.
Yeah, it's a good attitude to have. Do you find it hard? I know I do. Like, in terms of like the online content stuff, when you slog it out and you make something and then you put it online and it does sweet FA.
Yeah, man. Slave to the algorithm. But you know what? That's
got to be a tune. That's the title of your next rap track.
I'm very guilty of that stuff. It can really hit the mojo when you put something out. Like I put out a video, Cost of Living.
I love that, man. I thought it was wicked. See, that's the thing that it fucks me off a little bit, because I mean, I'm stating the obvious, but you know, you've got people who just put a phone in front of them and they do a vlog and it gets, you know, however many views. And then the stuff like that, where it's like, you've put in a lot of time and effort, is art. And the disparity is just, yeah. That's the YouTube algorithm, like you say.
Not even the algorithm, it's just what works will work for some people. But that, to use that as an example, that song's maybe 2 years old.
Okay.
I went to Ibiza, I shot the original video myself.
Okay.
It had a different beat and I changed producer for it. So that had two videos, two songs, and I worked on it for 2 years.
Yeah.
And then you put it out and it's like, doesn't even make a dent really, but you can't let that shit get to you. These new metrics and all this algorithm shit, these companies design it to pit you against your peers and make you think it's important. You shouldn't let it be important. Like if it can change one person, or, you know, if it had 800 views, that means that like 500 original unique viewers have seen it. That's great.
Yeah.
Think about it like that. I know it's not easy.
Have you always taken that perspective? Was that something that you've sort of grown to appreciate?
You have to just accept it.
Yeah.
I always graft and always try and get it seen and punt it the best I can. But what are you, you have to ask yourself, what are you doing it for?
Yeah.
What are you trying to do? Is it, do you just want to be famous? Do you just want to see 1 million hits? Do you just want to reach new people? How are you going to approach it? What can you do different? There's always things to do different. And it is hurtful. It's tough, but we're in a tough game. We're up against children who have billions of followers, man. What can I say?
Crazy times. Have you ever sort of like been tempted to just go down that route of churning out lots of content consistently?
Yeah, I've tried to do it. And it's hard. I have full respect for them. Like, I remember when the Dapper Laughs thing happened.
Oh, yeah.
Because I know Daniel. And putting aside his missteps with whatever he did, like, the guy is a content factory.
Yeah, unbelievable.
And you can't actually underestimate how hard that is to do. Like, the reason I don't vlog and put out a video every day, I don't want to look at my fucking face for hours editing my face.
Yeah.
Like, the people that do that, I respect it, man. It's crazy. There's an art to it.
Going back to what we're talking about, you know, having like a schedule for like your creativity and stuff, you've got to be seriously disciplined in terms of like your schedule, like, you know, to create the thing, write the thing, distribute it, get it out there. It's like
some comics are feet. Just outstanding at that side of it. And I'm trying to make myself better, but I try and avoid things like that, time consuming things. And I actually don't like putting too much work in promoting it, because like I said earlier, like, it does affect you.
Yeah.
Those numbers, the metrics. If you spend too much time trying to beat this system and algorithm, you're going to be disappointed. You just have to do what you can do.
Yeah. And then by the same token, when I put stuff on YouTube in the past, when I used to make sketches on there, and if, you know, they did do good numbers, the adrenaline and, you know, just, I just get into this cycle of just checking it and seeing views and the comments. That's not healthy either.
That's right. And they know what they're doing.
Yeah.
They know what they're doing. Like, you put on a video, I had a bit of material about it, like this whole thing on YouTube about thumbs up and thumbs down. And who the fuck invented that? How can someone watch a video of Neil Armstrong landing on the moon on YouTube and then say, thumbs down? Fuck you. But they knew what they were doing, because the whole point is it keeps you checking your phone. You get burned when you see a thumbs down.
Yeah.
You get a hit of serotonin when you see a thumbs up. But we didn't come in this game to see thumbs ups and thumbs downs. We came in to make what we make and do what we do. You have to remember that.
Yeah, this is true. Yeah, I think particularly during this period of time when everyone's just churning stuff out and you're not doing live, it's easy to get caught up in that and think, I need to be doing more.
The most important thing, advice for anyone in that position, is do nothing. That's a meditative thing that I try and think of all the time. There's a lot to be said for doing nothing and just living, breathing, doing day-to-day normal things. Don't rush and put stuff out just because. Actually take some time. Think about what you want to do and it will come to you. If you're just like hamstering on a wheel, you know, you'll be chasing highs that are meaningless.
Yeah, that's a great bit of advice. I wanted to ask you, are you a big a reader? And if so, have you read any books? Are there any books that come to mind over the years that have had a big impact on you?
Yeah, I'm a massive reader. I wish I had my Kindle here so I could tell you what I read. I love reading. I try. That's something I do. That's another thing I would say is important, if you're reading constantly, especially because if you consider yourself a writer and you're not reading daily, you're going to be writing bollocks probably. It's good to keep things flowing and be inspired from existing text.
100%.
Get some knowledge, get a bit of insight. I like to read all kinds of things, but I am drawn to fucking grim things as well, sadly. But I like all kinds of books.
Okay.
I love autobiographies.
Same. Any spring to mind that you really had an impact on you?
I like the Steve Jobs autobiography. I like Mike Tyson's. I read the Leonardo da Vinci biography. That was good.
Yeah, I'm quarter of the way through that one.
I like reading books about social issues, social justice. I like Laura Bates' Everyday Sexism. I like, what's that? I'm Not Talking to White People About Race. That's a good book.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. My favorite autobiography is The Chris Farley Show.
Okay. I haven't read that.
It made me cry because I love Chris Farley and it's very tragic portrayal of a talented guy. I read a lot of true crime. I like the Alan Partridge book. And you asked me about things for inspiration.
Any kind of books that have had a big impact on you or inspired you?
There's a book called Grit, The Power of Passion and Perseverance. I've heard of that.
Yeah.
I read a lot of self-help books, but they're mostly shit.
Eventually, you end up sort of repeating the same thing. I always find the self-help books, like for a week after, I'm buzzing. I'm like, yeah, I've got this. And then it completely just go back into my usual habits.
No, not even that long for me.
24 hours. On the true crime front, have you read Tough Jews?
No, is it any good?
So good. It's about the Jewish gangsters, sort of Meyer Lansky and those kind of guys, and how they paired up with Lucky Luciano. And yeah, it talks about the whole history of the New York Jewish gangsters and how they sort of were running things before the mafia.
Great. All right.
It's a great read. It's a really great read. And yeah,
I'll check that out.
And there's the author of that also wrote another book called Avengers, not the Marvel one, about a group of Jews who basically fought back against the Nazis and poisoned a load of them.
Okay. Yeah, I don't like Nazis, so that'll be good. What's that book? Oh, yeah. Bird by Bird, Some Instructions on Writing. That's the book I'd recommend for
writing. Great. Okay. Okay. Brilliant. Thank you.
The book.
Brilliant.
Yeah. Check that one out.
And I wanted to also just touch upon, you are, from what I gather, you've been quite vocal in terms of on anti-Semitism. You wrote an article, didn't you, in Chortle. Have you experienced like a fair bit of anti-Semitism firsthand as a comedian in industry?
Yeah, I have.
Right. in what shape or form is that? Is it from other comedians, promoters, or a mixed bag?
Both. But right. I don't see myself as like a victim.
No,
like,
sure.
It is what it is. I think people should have a bit more awareness about what constitutes it. Try and be a bit more supportive, because what I've discovered over the last few years is we're in a time where there's heightened empathy for lots of causes and they're all valid, but some are deemed more important than others. And yep. I'd like everything to be equal, because I'm about equality. I think people should just, read a little bit and figure out what constitutes a bit of anti-Semitism or, prejudice against all kinds of people, not just Jews.
Yeah.
Not too much to ask.
Yeah, I've always, because I might not necessarily be described as someone who looks particularly Jewish, in the past I've been described as what the Aryans are trying to create. And due to that, I've been privy to like anti-Semitism chat, or banter, really? Sorry. Yeah, on the inside, because often people, hadn't realized at the time I was Jewish. So it's really interesting. I found being able to witness to that as sort of as an insider's.
What did you hear?
Just the general lazy jokes and tropes. And it just comes up so casually. I mean, I'll give you an example, right? This is just this is a very small time comparison to sort of other things that I might have witnessed in the past or been exposed to. I went on a bike ride during lockdown. The one saving grace for me was me and a mate. We would go on these big bike rides and we'd go cycle into Hertfordshire and come back again. We stopped off somewhere in Hertfordshire, this little caff, and got chatting to these two geezers. They had a cup of coffee. And we just got chatting, and he's like, where do you live then? I said, I live in Stoke Newington. And I goes, oh, yeah, I used to live in Stamford Hill. He goes, but I'm not a Jew, though. Like, he said it just like so defensive. And I was like, okay, yeah, no, didn't think you were, mate. Didn't think you were. Just, that kind of thing.
The thing is, I've spoken out about anti-Semitism, not because, I have been affected directly by it.
Yeah.
But I don't speak out about it because I want to, because I'm such a campaigner for Jewish rights, because I'm so religious. It's just because I don't like hypocrisy. Like, I didn't know much about trans people, but I educated myself. I know trans people. Same with gay people. Same with black people. Where you educate about culture and you gain a bit more self-awareness and understanding. But with Jews, there seems to be like a bit of a blind spot for even well-meaning people. Because the truth is, I don't really want to be a poster boy against anti-Semitism, because many Jews are annoying.
Right? which is very true.
But if people are going to be hypocrites, I will call them out on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fair play. Okay, look, mate, I'm going to I'll wrap things up. I'm going to ask you the question I ask all guests on the podcast. What does the idea of balance mean to you or not?
What is the idea of balance? What do people usually answer?
To be honest, everyone has a completely different individual interpretation of it, so it's whatever that you interpret that.
So the question is, what is balance?
What does the idea of balance mean to you? And I say or not, because you might turn around and go, actually I don't believe in balance, I believe in going all in on this thing and nothing else matters.
I actually probably would lean towards that side of it, to be honest. Like, balance, I would say, is perspective.
Okay.
Balance is perspective. So as long as I got a roof over my head, I'm healthy, my family, friends are healthy, and I can do creativity, that's a healthy balance to me. Because creativity is where you can be a bit gnarly and fucking drive to Leeds and do a gig and come back and all that and feel like shit for a day. But you've got to keep perspective and look after yourself so that you're able to do that and not be too hard on yourself as well.
Great. All right, man, where can people find out about Joe and your content that you release on a lengthy basis?
Yeah, subscribe to my YouTube, Jester Jacobs.
Okay.
Jester Jacobs, and I'm on Twitter and Instagram with the same name.
Okay. All right, Joe. Thank you so much, man. I appreciate it.
Pleasure. Appreciate you too. You take it easy, all right?
Yeah, you too, bro.
All right, see you out there. Perfect.
And there we have it, Joe Jacobs in the building via Zoom. Great chat. So I've joined Fight Zone last week. I've been toying with the idea for ages. I'm sure you have heard on previous episodes that I used to do a bit of boxing and Thai boxing, and then I just stopped. And so I've gone to this MMA gym, and I've dabbled in a bit of Thai boxing and boxing, and I even tried Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, but I think that's a bit too risque with the old COVID, you know, rolling around with another sweaty person. I don't really feel that comfortable doing that, but it was very enjoyable. Hitting those bags, get out a lot of frustration. And the playlist they were playing was banging. Playing some 90s gangster rap. I was in the zone. You know, I was embodying my inner Rocky. And it's great. So much better than going to the gym, just lifting weights. That shit is boring. I find it so boring. So that's my sort of latest fitness endeavor. So in the next episode, I chat to Jacob Reed, who is from LA, lives over there, and he is a improv teacher at UCB. He's a comedy writer and director and just all round creative dude. So I'm very much looking forward to that one. So yeah, keep your eyes and ears peeled for that ep to drop. So until next time, guys, see you later.
Balancing Acts is made in association with The Comedy Crowd, who support independent comedy creators. They showcase the best new videos on comedycrowdtv.com and across media platforms. They support independent comedy creators and showcase the best new videos, including adult animation, sketch shows, web series, viral hits, and lots more. So if you're a creator, then do check them out.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.